Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar.
Tell Them You Love Me explores the extraordinary story of Anne Stubblefield, an esteemed university professor who becomes embroiled in a controversial affair with Derek Johnson, a nonverbal man with cerebral palsy. Anne says she unlocked Derek's mind from his body by teaching him how to communicate using a keyboard. Their relationship followed. I'll leave it there. It's a terrific documentary film called Tell Them You Love Me. We're joined today by the director of this wonderful film, Nick August Perna. Nick, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I do not remember this story. Apparently, it gained some national notoriety. The film is basically about the relationship. It's about a particular way of communicating between nonverbal people and others, the outside world, as well as a lot of attendant spinoff from what happened because of that relationship. Tell me a little bit about how you got onto this story. What inspired you to make Tell Them You Love Me?
Well, I did read the article. The article was written by Dan Engber. It was in the New York Times Magazine in 2015. He had attended, I think, most, if not all, of the trial. And the article ended, Anna had been found guilty and was facing up to 40 years in prison at the time. It was one of those articles that was, you know, very, very thorough and elaborate. It was a long read, but I sort of couldn't keep my eyes off it. I had grown up with an uncle who had, at the time, you know, he actually passed away during COVID. And so when he was a child, there was pretty rudimentary diagnoses for disability, right? And autism was not even a thing that people paid much attention to at the time. And so he was diagnosed just a very sort of generalized, you know, mental disability and cognitive disability. He was verbal, but, you know, I was always very curious about him as a kid. And we were very close. We spent all our family holidays together. We lived both in, I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and he was there. I saw him often. I was fascinated with him from a very young age. And, you know, one of the first things that gets sort of awakened when you read a story like this and you have people in your family with disabilities is, especially, you know, apparent cognitive disabilities, you think, did I miss something here, right? Was there like, oh my God, you know, is there something going on inside this person that I missed for, you know, in his case, 65 years, you know, by the time he passed away. So, you know, initially what drew me was that just very personal kind of the personal thrust of the nature of communication and unlocking people, you know, people being locked into their bodies and this kind of thing. And the method, the article is very focused on the method, facilitated communication, which is problematic, but has its own very, very complicated story, which I touch on in the film quite a bit. But I immediately was drawn to it. And I was one of those experiences as a filmmaker, which I haven't had many times where you're just like, I have to do this. I have to make the story, you know, it's like that voice, you know, deep inside you. And you're like, I got to just like listen to that voice and go do it. And so I wrote to her while she was at the county jail awaiting sentencing. I was in touch with the Johnsons. I met them in New Jersey where they live. And I immediately just started talking and meeting with them. I went to visit Anna in prison. She was sentenced ultimately to 12 years. And she was, you know, she was appealing the case. And I spent sort of the few years that she was, she ended up doing time researching and meeting with the Johnsons and meeting with her a few times. I didn't bring a camera along for several years because I wanted to make sure that I had the kind of the trust and the full transparency that this was going to be a 360-degree story. It wasn't just going to be some home run that was handed to either side. It was going to have to, you know, they had to do it because they wanted tell the very difficult, nuanced story that, you know, maybe some of it had gotten lost in the courtroom where everything gets pushed to these very, very clear binaries, right? And there's a lot of coaching going on from the legal teams because you want to win the case. They want to win the case, right? And so it's the motivation is not necessarily, oh, it's just about, you know, just, I mean, we know this, right? It's obvious to say it's not just about getting justice or getting to the truth or getting consensus on reality. It is about winning in that case. And there's so many emotions tied up to winning a case like this. So I think that everybody ultimately in the end did feel like there were parts of the story they wanted to be able to speak more openly about. There was, you know, things that had gotten kind of lost in the mix. I think both sides felt that the trial was unfair in one direction or the other. So without retrying the case, which was not what I wanted to do, I wanted to sort of just dive into them as people and tell this kind of Rashomon story of, you know, how you can have such different perspectives on the same reality, right? And that fascinated me. And I wanted to not just get to the bottom of it, but I wanted to go on that journey, which was kind of endlessly fascinating, you know, for those 7 years that I was making it.
Well, all that you said is true about the film, having watched it and seen all of the different people, and you had the benefit of having very compelling and seemingly very straightforward people in the film. Everyone feels like they said what they felt they needed to say from their point of view. And I didn't feel like there was a lot of prevarication or just sort of hedging. I thought everyone kind of came across as, this is straight up what I think was happening.
Yeah.
And which, again, at the end of the day, benefits the film, it benefits the story, and it also, in some way, invites the listener to be nuanced in their perception of what happens. I think that's a terrific accomplishment as a filmmaker and a storyteller, to feel like at the end of the day, I wasn't short-shifted. I wasn't steered in one particular direction or another. And I think the three main people, I think, I think you can say the up close and personal stories being told here. Anna Stubblefield, obviously, is big, and she starts out her first introduction is say, "I'm only here because I really know that I'm telling the truth," right? Which you could understand why she would feel some reticence, given how everything has gone. John Johnson, who was Derek's brother, I don't know if I've said Derek's name, Derek Johnson. I think I did in the introduction, yeah. But Derek Johnson is the person, the subject of the film in many ways, and yeah. His mother, Daisy Johnson, provide a real, as you mentioned, Rashomon, I think is a good description, getting to know them, getting to kind of understand where they were coming from, gaining their trust, one more than other. Obviously, Anna sounds like she was very much in for it, but just a little description on how you approach, you mentioned spending time with them without a camera, but just, you know, getting to know who they were as people, that sort of learning curve, if you will, for you and for them.
The learning curve is really almost a key phrase that you use because, you know, the structure of the film is in certain ways very complicated, but other ways very simple, right? Because there was one driving motivation or driving force behind the structure, the way it ultimately played out, which was to take people on as much of the experience that the characters had been on themselves, which was to say, you know, I didn't hold things back in the film on the audience to sort of like pull a fast one or to like trick people into thinking one way. I wanted people to get to go on the ride that they had been on together, that I had been on together, when I started following it. And to understand that this type of thing doesn't start out as just like as a good versus evil story, right? It's not like your serial killer story where there's just this unexplainable evil, you know, that's afoot in the premise of the story and the events. It's like the particularities of everything that every character brought to the table and the way that those life experiences and lived experiences of identity and childhood and disability and all the other forces, the way that sort of slowly enmeshes them in this tragedy together, right? And I felt it was important to track that process. I believe everyone had good intentions in the beginning. That's what's so complicated. And whether there's an ethical question about whether that matters in terms of deciding guilt or not in the end, do the intentions mean anything? That's a question to sort of talk about. But I do believe it started with, you know, everyone had a shared goal, which was to unlock the mystery of Derek and to help Derek communicate more and better and more vividly and to be self-determined. Everybody shared that goal, right? So that's what makes it, for me, such a tragedy, because it did start that way and it ended, you know, in sort of such disaster, right? So I think that the learning curve is felt in the film, right? As you go, I think you learn things, you uncover things, and it's a really is in that way. It is a kind of a detective story where you are sort of finding evidence that's not necessarily material evidence, but kind of, you know, circumstantial evidence, background of the science of the thing, of personal histories. And you're kind of slowly piecing it together and trying to create a picture that's sort of larger than the sum of its parts and make a determination on something that is almost endlessly complex, right? So anyway, so it's to your point about a learning curve. And I think, you know, I made it very clear to everybody that that was what I wanted to do with this. So I wanted them to, even though it was, you know, hindsight is 2020, right? But I wanted to get them back into that place where everyone could really lock into what initially drove them to each other, right? And then how things unfolded in the way that they did.
And just to take a half a step back, Derek has been uncommunicative since birth, basically. He was never verbal. And you can understand it, just a natural sense of a parent or a brother or anyone who loves someone to hope for the best, to unlock. We've all seen movies where people unlock their potential, and you want to believe that that's possible with whoever you are in that situation with. So you have that. You have all that emotional momentum to want to believe that this is something that can be addressed in a way that will make Derek's life much more fulfilling in the world that we know it as. And then also the reliance on something that's controversial, that also kind of, I don't want to use the wrong word here, encourages people who believe it to be something effective, this facilitated communication. And then on top of it, whether it's through by design or by chicanery, it seems to work. I mean, that's complicated, right? Because we have people in the film who absolutely are convinced that this is the way forward. Then you have people in the film who are absolutely scientifically convinced that it is not the way forward. So you have these things going on, and you throw into it, these are people's lives. These are people, real people's lives being impacted. And Anna throughout is a very compelling person. Whatever demons may haunt her, whether they are or not demons, is hard to reconcile with all of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the thing that I sometimes, when I'm talking to people after they watch it, that I remind people of is, it's not just some professor who taught disability, right? It's not just some lady who was sort of interested and learned this thing. Like, you know, she had grown up around it, right? And so she was this intellectual that had a focus on ethics, of all things, in the philosophy, was the chair of the philosophy department, and she had a special sort of knowledge of disability studies. Even though there wasn't a disability studies department at the school, she would infuse her classes, her philosophy and ethics classes, with disability, which is why she showed the film that John watched and that started the whole story in motion. But my point is that it was that's what I mean by particular experiences, right? She had grown up with a different paradigm than most of us, as did the Johnsons. They had grown up with a different paradigm than most of us. Like, you can't just bring your experience and kind of generalize it to everything else, right? Like, everything that we do and live through informs the way we see the world, and you have to meet people on their level to understand that, right? You have to acknowledge that and meet them there. And say, okay, this is her story, and this is their story, and there's this strange inevitability that's sort of tragic about the way that those experiences collided, you know, in life. But So for me, it's extremely important that she, you know, she did have that background. She's not just some random professor. I was just going to say, and the strange part, I think, for the audience in terms of positioning is you also learn things from her, teaching you things about disability that I do think are important. And there's a lot of it that's relevant, right? Like, many of the characters in the film, Howard Shane, Rosemary Crossley, Sandy, who is Anna's mom, who was, you know, one of the early kind of pioneers in the field. They are all about the same age and they've spent their lives pursuing the same things. And they kind of agree on a lot of things up to a certain point, you know, which is this method. So there's a kind of a shared value system there up to a point. And that's what makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, that I think is absolutely critically important to understanding all the motivations of many of the people in this. And I don't want to stretch this point too far because I think you can get into troubling kind of conclusions, but about the people. But there is a bit of a schism here that reminds me of what we're going through in society writ large, and that is what science says and how I feel about something.
Sure.
We are dealing with this. This is a modern phenomena that is harkens back to 500 or 600 years ago, where science, the Age of Enlightenment. I think there's a retrenchment on the blood of a lot of people in the Western world, the modern world, where the Age of Enlightenment is being, there's a pushback that science is not everything. It's how I feel about something.
Sure.
And you can stretch that into religion. There's a lot of places where this ends up being this issue.
Yeah.
Does that sound right to you?
Oh, I so appreciate you bringing that up. I mean, any sort of great story for me has to have that ingredient of, you know, call it allegory or sort of like, you know, existential questions about that have some revelation beyond just the specifics of the story themselves. It's a very, in this case, extreme story, but it sometimes those extreme stories, you know, can be all the more illuminating for the rest of us because it's like looking at our experience under a magnifying glass or certain parts of our experience. And I think that it is about how I feel, but it's also about when our hopes and our feelings come up against reality or science, we are ill-equipped more than ever, I think, to bridge the kind of gap of that cognitive dissonance that happens there, right?
Yeah.
That dissonance is an incredibly uncomfortable place to be. And the kind of the reaction that goes into full throttle of the ego to try to mend and reinforce itself is so powerful, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that it's the confirmation bias thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, and because of, you know, social media, I know it's like broken record because everybody talks about this nowadays, but because of that, you can go out and you can confirm what you believe if you look for it long enough. Even if it's the most cockamamie, crazy thing anyone's ever heard, you will find a community of people that share that view and that spend all their time reinforcing it for each other, right? Pry yourself out from the grip of that confirmation is, I think, something that is not only, it's already hard to do, but when people are reinforcing it for you all the time, it's even that much harder, right? And it's happening in every issue you can think of now. I do think the story is a very interesting allegory for that. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why it resonates with people in this, maybe even if they're not conscious of that, because it takes a second to think and process the film, but on some level, I think it's triggering this kind of universal experience we're having of that. That's when the disconnect of our feelings, our fantasies, our feeling of assuredness about our positioning in the world, when that starts to break down and get challenged, you know, how difficult it is to find your way back.
I couldn't agree more.
That's uncomfortable.
I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with the director of a terrific documentary film called Tell Them You Love Me. That would be Nick August Perna. and the film is opening. Is it the 21st? Are we opening this week, this Friday?
No. So it didn't play theaters. It opened on Netflix on June 14th.
That's right.
It actually miraculously yesterday it held the number one spot in the U.S. and today it's the number two spot. And that is extraordinary, you know, for a film like this, I think.
My congratulations. Again, I'm so glad to hear the reception that it's received on Netflix. I think people who will listen to our conversation and who have seen it on Netflix, hopefully, will understand so much more about our somewhat cryptic description at times about the film.
The beginning of a conversation, because I think when they watches it, you know, those are when the real kind of crazy conversations happen. And then they're happening. They're happening on X right now. They're happening on TikTok, and they happen at dinner tables. And that's actually, it's very exciting for me to think of all these people arguing about it.
Well, good on them for having those discussions. And also good on you for creating the premise. And the film is called Tell Them You Love Me. We've been speaking with the director, Nick August Perna. Nick, thank you so very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great. Great conversation. Thanks.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.